Hi, how exciting. Here we are again, podcasting for the first time in a month on episode 2 of Each and Every Dog. I'm joined tonight by my regular sidekick, Steve Rogers. How are you tonight?
I'm good, thank you, Matthew. Good to talk to you tonight again. Episode number 2, exciting stuff.
It sure is. And joined by very dear friend and regular contributor, Anne Glennie. How nice to hear you, Anne.
Hello, nice to be back. I was very tempted to bark there. Each and every dog, I felt like woof.
there's a bone, a digital bone on its way to you.
Eventually we will have to have some sort of a ban on those sort of puns, but for the moment, just make merry. We're not worried at all about that. Well, this is a special Easter weekend episode, really. So I don't know about you guys, but I'm fairly demob happy. You know, it's been a busy time at work, but Steve and I had always envisaged tonight that we would have a glass of wine while we did this podcast, so it's not the BBC, so I can say that my Yellowtail Cabernet Sauvignon is terribly nice. What are you enjoying, Steve?
A Rioja tonight from the Rioja region. I'm not sure which one it is, actually.
Okay.
But it's getting better the longer it sits next to the warm computer, I have to say.
Yeah, that does help. Anne, and are you being good and shaming us tonight?
I'm just reading my bottle. It's a Pure Life Still Spring Water. There you are.
Is it high?
To camera, just to prove. There you go.
Is it Highland?
No, I can't. I think it might be French. It says Nestle on it.
How appropriate with your Parisian.
Oh, wait a minute. Bottled at source in England. There we go.
All right. Okay. Well, how appropriate as we reach out across the border to you in England there, Steve. So I guess people will know which opinion out of the three of us then that they can actually give any kind of
credence to.
Early on in the cast, I've just opened this one, so I'm sure my opinions early on have still got something. Serious, I'm going to say, I better say earlier. So first of all, I'm just going to get a moan out of the way, if you don't mind. It's not anything anyone's done. It's just, boy, have I had a frustrating week. It's been really tough. I have been really enjoying writing for Each and Every Dog. We were never really all that sure how this would pan out, but I'm loving it. I actually find that I really enjoy writing. I like the articles. I like the discipline of thinking things through. But guys, I'm stuck. You know, towards the last week or two, my output has just dried up. And there's a reason for it. If you're listening, Gillian Hamilton, our chief executive of the newly established Scottish College of Educational Leadership, she flattered me immensely by asking on Twitter if I would write a guest blog for the Scale website. And I was just tickled pink, cock-a-hoop. Because I thought, I'm on a roll, I'm enjoying writing, that's good. What's your topic? I asked her, and she said, teacher leadership. Do you know, I have now had three different evenings that I've given at least 2 hours of, you know, of that sort of, you know, odd half-hearted blogging, when I've actually now written and accumulated 2,000-plus words on the topic, and it's rubbish. I just, you know, I read it back, and I think, there's no flow in this. I'm coming to an idea that reads negatively, you know, I'm wrestling. It's the most unpleasant blogging experience I've had in ages. A bit of me is thinking I should just walk away and leave it, but I can't. I feel as if I want to finish it. I want to beat it.
Yeah.
But you need an angle.
Yeah.
You need to get an angle on it to make the writing happen, if you like. I was at a conference last weekend, and you know, I've come away because I saw and heard so many different speakers. I've got months of blogging that I could do now. You know, it's given me that little bit of inspiration and a wee bit of a push. I think you always need something sort of to base it on, and maybe your topic's too wide. You need something to narrow it down for you.
That's very insightful, actually, Anne. I think there is a bit of that. The first sort of, you know, 2,000 words flow. I did what you're supposed to do. It's free writing, you call it, isn't it, Anne?
When
you
just
self-censor, you just go for it and then, you know, go through it again. But the trouble is, because it's such an ill-defined piece, I suppose the point that I was getting drawn into was to try and challenge the very, you know, idea of it, that it is so poorly defined that we need to, you know, agree something about it or admit forever that it's just vacuous like so many other ideas, you know. But what happens then is you start defining the possibilities and it becomes just a vast romp through the possibilities. You know, and that isn't then snappy. You know, it just becomes dull. But anyway, I don't want to post-mortem the piece anymore. I've just found it cathartic to share with my people, you know, and to get that off my chest. So I'm going to one way or another. I'm going to manage it next week.
Yeah, absolutely. You have been hyperactive on the magazine, on Each and Every Dog this month, Matthew. I mean, there's 15 posts this month, four of which are short quotes. I think you've provided the majority of them. But it's just interesting. It's an interesting experience blogging, isn't it? Because, first of all, you're never sure of the audience, but you need to be really succinct and you also need to explain yourself really well. Yeah. So I find there's a different kind of discipline. I mean, one of my problems with writing is that I'm a bit of a perfectionist and I know it's a fault. I suppose it's insecurity, but I can't let anything go until I've think, yeah, that'll pass the quality test, you know. And maybe with blogging you need to lower the threshold a bit, just sort of get on with it. I don't know.
I'm sure there is something in that. Anyway, Anne, what's your recent time? You're like, tell us something about the new venture again and, you know, what's going on in your life?
Well, Learning Zoo is going really well, keeping me busy. I'm just about to launch a new course, so I'm working hard on that just now, so there won't be much time to relax in Easter holidays for me. But the new course is called Phonics Forever, and it's about phonics. There's a surprise. My current course, Reflective Reading, it focuses mainly on comprehension, higher order skills, how to embed those in teaching of reading, and how to cultivate a reading culture. So this next course, it's the opposite side of the coin, if you like. It's about how do we actually teach children how to read properly from the beginning.
Wow. Well, as my little 3-year-old begins to show increasing interest in the shapes of the words in the books, I'm going to be picking your brain about what I can do to help her.
It is amazing watching young children learning to read, isn't it? I mean, our grandchildren are really getting into it. And our 2-year-old grandson is loving books. He's just going back to the same picture books. There's one with the diggers and tractors in it. He keeps getting out. And he says, read me, please. He goes, so he sits on my sits on my knee and I have to go through this book again. I'm thinking, oh, no, not again. But he loves it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Because they get to that stage where you can't miss a bit out because they kind of start to say, oh, what does that say?
You've missed
that bit, yeah.
Yeah. You missed those pages.
It's funny that you know that you're supposed to be doing the right thing by the child and, you know, doing what's best for her future, but there are nights when she goes and picks particular books that my heart sinks. I think, oh, no,
yes.
Surely no.
And then absolutely.
You start negotiating. This is really for two nights, Hannah. Could we, you know?
Yeah.
Can we do up to page 372 just now, you know, and then cut it off there?
Yeah.
Due exaggeration allowed for.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. But the business is going well. I mean, I just have to say to our listeners again, we just love the branding. We love the whole look and feel of what you're doing. The site is just beautiful. It's great. And it's so important because when something's about learning and creating a mood of excitement around learning, branding matters. You know, it has to be something that doesn't make you feel corporate and businessy. It has to make you feel as if you practice what you preach, you know, and that you've got an ability to put things across motivationally. And for me, Anne, I just think you've nailed it. You've absolutely nailed it.
Thank you.
Partly disappointed that Jeffrey's not there with you now, though.
Jeffrey's here. I could go and get him. He's right. He's on the other side of the room. He's listening. But actually, no, I'm really proud of the website because it's something, and this links into one of your posts, actually, Matthew. It's something that I've had to teach myself. So the post that you'd written, I'm not sure if it was this week or last week, about, you know, not being satisfied with your typing speed or technique.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, what pushed you to learn and try and improve that. I suppose that really resonated with me because until I've got a reason to do something, I don't do it.
Mm-hmm. I thought one of the interesting things about that piece, Matthew, was about how you said about putting another part of the jigsaw in, you know, that there's things that could have made the push the learning that much further had you had that part of the jigsaw. So it's kind of knowing which parts of the jigsaw fit together to direct the learning.
Okay, well,
does that make sense?
You've segued us into a review of the month.
Yeah, well, don't tell the listeners what we're doing.
Well, no, but I was just going to say that in a preamble, you did say you wanted to talk about last night's leadership debate. So why don't we finish the cast later on with a wee chat around that?
Right,
well, let's crack on then. Aye, and in that piece, well, that was also part of why the second half of my my month for the Each and Every Dog site was slower, because actually writing was physically hurting me. I mean, literally my left arm, the upper arm, was aching because I was trying to force myself to use all my fingers. But you're right, in this case it was easy. The article was really about, first of all, you know, just the catharsis of saying, look guys, you know, be kind to me, I'm having a hard time here. but that's stopped now, and of course the article was really just reflecting on how easy it was to know. You know, I've always known I'm pecking with that finger. You know, and that it's important as you start to enjoy writing that you can kind of keep up with the voice in your head a little bit. And I was doing nothing like that. You know, the ideas were streaming out of my head. And then I'm having to check, now, where did I think I was going with that again, now that I've caught up with that paragraph? Mm-hmm. And that's not flow. So it was an easy analysis, you know. But Steve, you're right. The whole point was then to try and widen that out and just say, you know, this is kind of one-dimensional. Everyone knows what you should do to type, and everyone knows if you don't have the proper technique. You know, I mean, it's not as if there are 15 different schools of thought around how you type, you know. We all know which fingers are supposed to go roughly where, and that, yes, it's a tough discipline, but if you can nail it, you know, then the likelihood is you'll get faster in the longer run, you know. But actually, I was reflecting on a maths experience, which I'm sure I may have shared way back in our old days on Inside Learning.
Yes, you did, yeah.
I was a maths phobic, and for our English listeners, all grades in Scotland when I was a lad are very like the O levels in England. They were never directly the same, but it was the same age range of youngster, and it led into our hires, which were kind of like leading into A-levels. You would do a few more hires that's slightly less rigorous than A-levels, but they were broadly analogous, you know, so it was the same kind of level pre-university. Well, they threw me out of maths anyway when I was, doing my O-grade maths, and it was to save my arithmetic, so I had 8 periods a week of arithmetic, and I only just scraped a C. It was literally a C, so I wasn't even good at arithmetic, So I was always mildly phobic, but bizarrely I liked physics, and eventually I persuaded myself that I liked electronics. So I went to college, you know, and did a further education course, which, to cut a long story short, it's now Paisley University of West of Scotland. It was Paisley Tech when I went. They had a really exciting course called Physical Sciences for Microelectronics, which was for microchip manufacture. So you did chemistry, you did the kind of main bit of the chemistry and the physics and the maths and the electronics courses. They all had a kind of an A and B section, so we just did the A bits of each one to set you up to serve the various wafer fabs that were in Scotland at the time. And it was great, really exciting, but I went for that course never having believed that I would do a degree. You know, it was never on my radar at all. So when I got taken on to an HND, then I got cocky and thought, oh well, maybe I didn't think I could get that either, you know, maybe I could ask. So I asked them and they said yes, and they said that you don't have maths though at all. You know, I had a crash O grade in it that I did in my fifth year at school, and I got a C. You won't be surprised, you know, I only just scraped through that. And they took this qualification I had in diploma electronics, which had probably less maths in it than my C grade, O grade, you know. So they were kind of being generous to me because I'd been out of school for 3 or 4 years by then. And it was this guy who did a diagnostic night with me, just an old school friend. I'd met him, you know, in a social event, and he'd said, you know, when I told him, look, I'm terrified, I know I'm going to be out my depth, I'm going to, you know, to study stuff with physicists and people, and I'm going to drown. And I would have done, I have to say, truthfully, I really wasn't ready for it. And he spent this kind night with me when we probably had a beer together or something. And he talked me through it and he got me to do some stuff. He pulled out some books. And he did what good teachers would do, even though he wasn't in any way a qualified teacher. He tried to reverse engineer and figure out, where's it breaking down? So like the typewriter thing, it's easy to see. It's breaking down at my fingers. I know it. Any fool can see it. I didn't know what my own problem was in maths. And when he figured out, this is where you've gone wrong, let's go back there, give you some stuff, I'll loan you this book, go and do that. And, you know, I never became a maths genius, but I did become a maths teacher eventually, you know, and I never failed a maths exam again, you know, throughout my degree. So it's made me very, very, you know, to use that tired word, very passionate about how quickly we dismiss young people, you know, about, you know, he's not got the talent for that, he's not good at that. And Steve, as you said, sometimes it's that there's a very linear approach to the learning these things, and if you've missed a piece in the, you know, in the puzzle, you can't build on the missing piece. So sometimes if we could give people a chance to go back and revisit that and, you know, build that foundation again, I'm convinced that people can move on, you know, with much more success.
Yeah, I think the reverse engineering is a good metaphor for that. Yeah, and looking at where the breakdown was. I mean, the other thing that struck me about that was the coaching aspect. We don't often coach, reverse engineer, then coach from that point, do we? It's quite a...
Well, interestingly enough, the guy in question, Stephen Blake, I'm sure he's not listening, but if he does, I really thank you, Stephen. That was a generous thing to do. But he was studying engineering. I can't remember whether it was electric. I think it might have been electrical engineering. Maybe there is something in that mindset. You know, maybe he saw it as a technical problem. He probably had an algorithm in his head.
Yes.
You know, breakdowns of different stages. You know, it would be an interesting piece to write on its own, as whether engineers would actually make good teachers because of that approach. Yeah, who knows?
I thought what's interesting about that is, you know, we failed you the first time around, and it was lucky you were able to get, you know, a second chance at it. I love the end to the story where you became a math teacher.
Yeah, yeah, I've always liked her. Now, the truth is that I'm over-egging the pudding a bit there, because I was a math teacher for 1 year, and it was because that's, you know, I was qualified by then, and it was the only job that was going, and I took it because, you know, I wanted a job. But honestly, I don't think I was a great math teacher. I was a pretty good physics teacher, but anyway, it's a nice twist.
That was there was another question about your post that was interesting, because the post you did on becoming a better person, because I was really into Joy Division. I was shocked to know that
I've written too many posts this month.
You've been prolific. I would say hyperactive almost, but there you are. Because I was really into Joy Division. I was shocked to know that they.
I'm delighted that you're into Joy Division, and you'll be probably too young for Joy Division.
I'm just wondering
what Joy Division is.
It was. Oh, where was the name taken
from? It was
the
band that became New Order.
Yeah, well,
if you know of New Order.
I've heard the name, yes.
Yeah, the classic.
Remember that big classic? The
classic single
ever, I think.
Classic single, Joy Division single, was Love Will Tear Us Apart. Do you remember? Anyway.
Oh, you young thing, you. Yeah. As my grandmother used to say when she was to the fore, she used to say about young people, she said, she wouldn't tear in the plucking. Oh, no, it was the other way around. She'd say it about old people. Sorry, are you tearing the plucking?
Say.
Sorry, it's the wrong way around.
Yeah. Anyway, they said, Bernard Summer says, we never listen to the lyrics.
It's an amazing story, isn't it? You know, I built 2 years of my teenage angst on listening to Joy Division and these lyrics about, you know, I took the blame and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
There must be a better way, I took the blame. Just angst-ridden stuff, you know. And his French girlfriend is saying, you know, to the manager of the band and everyone as they're beginning to become more successful, you know, you know, seriously, guys, Ian Curtis has gone off the rails. You know, I'm sure she didn't say Ian Curtis. Ian's gone off the rails. Listen to his lyrics, they're terrible, you know. And the interviewer in this BBC documentary that I was watching that prompted the piece asked Bernard Summers this, and he said, I can't do the Brummie accent, of course, that he has.
Manchester.
You're right, Mancunian accent, forgive me. And he says, you know, we were just doing the music, you know, we never really listened to what he was singing.
Yeah.
thousands of us, probably a million or so of us across the UK that were, you know, that were living these lyrics, you know, in the meaningful kind of.
I wasn't a teenager at the time, but yeah, I remember the lyrics were quite important, weren't they? Especially as that live album Closer was, a lot of it was out of tune. But the point being that you were talking about mindfulness and awareness of others, which I thought was a really interesting point, because I just wanted to ask you about something else you wrote. Then you wrote about gym flicks. And kind of drawing on behavioral economics and how you could bundle stuff together.
I'm really feeling the pressure here, guys.
Yeah, you should do. Well, you're right. You put yourself out there this month, Matthew, so I'm sure you can turn the tables in a minute. But you wrote about, in Gym Flicks, you write about the notion taken from behavioral economics about bundling stuff. Like, so, for example, if you want to work out at the gym and you find it a bit hard, you kind of bundle it together with maybe an audio book you wanted to listen to, that kind of thing. So I wondered how the temptation bundling, as they call it, in behavioral economics, and mindfulness work, because it seemed to me that mindfulness wouldn't kind of necessarily sit alongside temptation bundling. I don't know. Have I misread that?
I'm going to be really honest here and say that I don't really know that I'm able to answer that. Very, very deliberately, Anne, what I've been trying to do this month is to get in touch with some different kinds of learning. I think one of the things that's in the spirit of Every Dog is that we're trying to think differently, be a bit more eclectic, you know, and we certainly don't want to just be a school learning website, although that stuff's, you know, it's maybe the base that we come from. So these are two disparate pieces of learning that I've picked up and just let myself get into them. And I don't know how they knit together, Steve. In fact, I'd welcome your thoughts on it yourself, Steve. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the mindfulness point is really important. And there's a lot of, I know our dear friend Sarah Romanchik gave me a book before I left the last organization on mindfulness, which was written by I can't find it on my bookshelf now, but it was written by a neuroscientist. So it's becoming a big kind of study within neuroscience, but it's also got a quite a long moral history, philosophical history, and obviously in the Buddhist tradition and Eastern traditions, you know, mindfulness is really important, and that whole thing about flow that social psychology, you know, Csikszentmihalyi talks about, that's also got a thing about mindfulness in it. So it seems to be quite an important element of a rich learning experience, and I'm just wondering. I mean, I don't know either. I'm just wondering how, and if you're bundling up stuff, you know, if you're frenetically working out at the gym while you're listening
to
an audio book,
you can reward yourself at the same time.
That's right. How mindful are you being? Does mindfulness require that? In fact, you almost become contemplative. You know, like Aristotle talked about Sophia, which is this kind of theoretical wisdom. I mean, he thought one of the ultimate aims of a good life was that you kind of sit in some more abstract, quiet contemplation. I'm not sure exactly how you do that, but that was his view. And there's a kind of quite a long philosophical tradition of mindfulness. And as I was saying, it's also becoming part of a neuroscience sort of investigation. So there's obviously a lot in it. So I don't know either. I'm just sort of thrown out, because it seems to me the more stuff you bundle together, the more busy you are, the less mindful you might be.
Yeah, and there's also something artificial about the temptation bundling, you know, that in a sense you've set yourself out on a construct, an artificial construct, and you're then trying to guide your behaviour with the artificial tram lines that you've put down. Whereas mindfulness, you're right, would seem to suggest that you don't do that, that you try and listen carefully, stay in touch, be aware of the signals and things around you, you know. So yeah, I think these could be quite contradictory things. I'm not sure whether they even can sit together. The reason that I got interested in the mindfulness thing was I don't even know if it's the right term, you know. It may well be that I'll be looking back in a month or two saying, actually, I've called that mindfulness when it, you know, maybe isn't, I don't know. But it was partly because some time ago I had a colleague who went off work with some stress or something really, you know, related to that anyway, you know, and I hadn't noticed. And it troubled me, you know, and it's kind of sat with me a bit. So, you know, really when I realised Bernard Summers thinking, you know, our lead singer's going to kill himself and none of us have been bothering to listen to his lyrics when every sign is there that he's in that dark place, you know. It just resonated, and I thought, you know, it was more just about being a better listener, I think, you know, in a sense, rather than mindfulness. So I may have picked up on a buzz phrase or idea there that maybe wasn't the right one. I don't know. Fan, have you had any dealings with mindfulness stuff?
I did do Buddhism as part of my higher religious studies. But no, I don't know. Your gym flick stuff doesn't appeal to me. Just combining the gym with anything, even if you offered me Easter eggs while I was on the gym bike, still not going to work.
No.
I did try to come up with some combinations that would tempt me, but
of course, you know, as you know, the point wasn't the gym. You know, I could maybe have thought, you know, writing would be the discipline that you would be, you know, looking to reward yourself. You know, finish another chapter of your book, but you know, at the same time, what would be the reward that you know that you always feel a little bit guilty about? But if you could tie it together with that.
I don't know if the concept is good, you know, but bribing yourself, you're almost cheating yourself.
You know, temptation bundling is so much sexier sounding than bribing yourself, right, man. You're pulling down our blog titles here. dear. Yes, what's in a name indeed? But come on, you have made me curious. What? Right, you're not going to do it because you're of sterner moral stuff than this. But what would it be? What would tickle you pink if you gave yourself the treat for writing another chapter in your book?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm too good to myself anyway. So
hug a llama.
I couldn't even. No, another alpaca.
Oh, sorry, I mixed up. Yeah, listeners will think, where's that from? I should just mention to me that Anne. Has a small herd of alpaca.
Yes, very small now. I think we're at 7 now because we sold all the girls.
You bring no, them honestly, your house and see how small that herd feels.
I think, you know, when it comes to writing, you've got to be motivated anyway. Yeah. You can't put in any sort of external motivation there. Offer me 10 alpacas. Your writing's not going to be any use unless it's coming from a motivated place. You're probably really disappointed to hear this, Matthew, but I was reading a book recently and it's called Find Your Thing. Very short book, not particularly well written, extremely repetitive. However, when I was reading it, I really had a bit of an epiphany and I thought, do you know what? Writing is not my thing. Writing fiction is not my thing because it's too hard, it's too difficult, it's not coming from the right place, and I'm not determined enough to make it happen. So with that in mind, this book has convinced me to leave writing fiction alone because it's clearly not my thing. But I have found on the other side of the coin that I do feel writing about education is my thing. So, because it comes to me a lot more easily than writing fiction does.
Wow. Actually, what you're making me think there is that another facet of that post around gym flicks, which was just for listeners you know, who haven't obviously looked at the post, who might want to go and look at it, it really wasn't about the gym or anything. It was just about the idea that there are things that we find hard to get discipline in. And, you know, there is that well-known trick that if you can find a way of bundling these things, you know, something you like or something you don't, then you know, there's some evidence that in the short term, I mean, they made that clear on the podcast that gave me the thought, that in the short term, it's sometimes just about re-establishing the habit. But there was something very interesting also, which is really the kind of hidden point of that podcast, which was that I got that from the Freakonomics podcast, from the authors of the Freakonomics book, which I've never read. It's on my list. I'll get around to it eventually. But the guy who mainly presents their podcast, which they call Freakonomics Radio, very high production value podcast. They use a lot of old music pieces on it. You know, it's very funky and lovely. So, you know, they will pull up a wide audience in a way that I'm sure lots of podcasts don't. But Stephen Dubner also did an episode recently. You know, he's the presenter and he's lovely, he's very charismatic and appealing and you know, not frightening. He doesn't browbeat you with anything, he just plays with ideas. But one that would appeal to you was he did one on the power of letting things go. You know, how good it is in your life sometimes not to keep on grinding on and developing something, but sometimes to know when, actually, what I've learned now, as you say, is, not that I agree with you incidentally, but we'll let that go. that you know, that what I've learned is, you know, I'm wasting time now. It's like the economic argument about, you know, stop. What's that phrase? Isn't it stop putting good money after bad? Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, stop investing in something that's not going to give you a long term return. And Dubner himself talked about, as a youngster, he actually played in a band that was you know, beginning to have mild success, and, you know, like, had a manager and were getting tours and things. But in the end, you know, he decided to focus on his behavioural economics career, and he's now obviously a very famous author and very successful. And he said, you know, one of the great bits of learning for him was that he had to know that that wasn't his future. He was never going to be happy doing mm-hmm. that.
I think that, and that would be an aspect of mindfulness, I think, as I understand it.
Yes.
That you're attentive to the problem at hand, and you're attentive to the context and your place in it. And I think certainly in with regard to other people, in terms of compassion, having compassion, I mean, that requires mindfulness, I think. I think it's a perfectly good phrase to use for that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, the behavioural economic stuff, because obviously, you know, Cameron was quite interested in it, wasn't he, when he came in 2010, he set up the nudge unit, you know, and all this stuff about how do we move people from, instead of sort of beating people over there and saying smoking's going to kill you, you know, how do we nudge them into more healthy behaviours? And we've really not cracked it, have we? We're still... You know, because actually what I was listening, I can't remember who it was now, was on somebody from the NHS was on the radio this morning saying, you know, that actually what Western society does is promote unhealthy lifestyles. It hasn't learned how to promote the value of healthy ones.
Although the Dutch units had some significant successes, I think, I'm not a big fan of it, but, you know, they haven't done nothing. You know, they've you know, the pensions thing came out of that, you know, that lots of people have got pensions now just because we've reset the default. You know, that lots of people were kind of trusted to, you know, remember when you get round to take out a pension if you don't have one with your business. Now they've set it as a default, you know. They're not forcing it on anyone. You know, you now just have to make the effort to opt out of it rather than to opt in. You know, it's that kind of thing that's about behavioural economics, that we know what the tendencies are that people have, so let's try and help them to make the right choices.
yeah, that's fine. Yeah. No, yeah. I don't understand that. And you do need a kind of benign state in order to have that view, don't you? Which is why I find it quite interesting that it's come from a very kind of libertarian perspective, you know, government.
Yeah.
Or, you know, supposedly libertarian government.
Well, one of the other nice things in Thaler's book, I can't remember his first, is it Richard Thaler is the guy that wrote Nudge?
Yeah.
He wrote a lovely bit. I've never seen an example of it, but it tickled me pink that apparently the Nudge unit looked at tax chasing letters. When they would send people these letters saying, you know, we're going to prosecute you, you know, you could be liable for up to 10 years in prison, blah, 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 you know, you owe your taxes. And in their research on this, they found you can make a significant difference to the tax collected by writing a letter instead that said, do you know what? The hospitals in your area have been really struggling. Can we just tell you about, you know, the cancer, you know, sort of treatments they've been doing recently, and how important it is for us that we collect your taxes? So, you know, thanks very much. You know, we're still waiting for your tax, and they got bigger collection rates.
No, I can understand that. I can understand. It's like that. I don't know if you see that lovely cartoon. It's just the one frame with. There's obviously a very rich American standing on a beach with a hand around the shoulders of his mate. And he's got a big sign on the beach saying, beware sharks. And he said, this works so much better than saying private beach, keep off.
Listen, Steve, I want to come on to talking about one of your articles, but just in case we lose it, can I just mention, we did have a couple of quotes in this month. I just want to talk about Leonard Nimoy's last tweet. Did you pick that one up, Anne?
Yes.
I saw it on Twitter.
Yeah, that's where I saw it as well. I just thought, how great it would be if we had the luxury of being able to put out a well-thought-out last tweet like that that would be so shared. Just for listeners, we certainly can't read articles out, but for listeners that may want to go, so that don't have each and every dog in front of them just now, his last tweet was, "A life is like a garden. Perfect moments can be had, but not preserved except in memory." LLAP, as in Live Long and Prosper, from the man who played Spock.
Yeah.
Do you know what? It did make me well up.
Yeah.
It doesn't often happen, but, you know, this sap I welled up at that. Oh, that's just, you know, you grow up with a character like that, don't you? You know, and what a gift he gave us there, just in reminding us to, you know, to seize the day a bit. That's lovely.
There's a Terry Pratchett one you put up as well, which is lovely. There are times in life when people must know when not to let go. Balloons are designed to teach small children this.
There have been two very sad losses this month, haven't they? Both big learners. You know, you start reading the story about Leonard Nimoy and you realise that he was a photographer as well. You know, he took that up in later life. And quite a groundbreaking one. You know, he did some quite radical, you know, stuff that was uncomfortable. You know, that he liked to push the margins a bit, you know. And then you think about the Discworld, you know, and the, you know, the amount of stuff in there that challenges accepted perceptions. You know, he actually, in his playful, humorous world, takes things that we all believe that it would be hard for an academic to go and say, you know, guys, seriously, do we believe this? Do we think that? He could make it fun. And by the end of it, you know, you could playfully be challenging your own perceptions. Plus, he had lots of things that were just weaving in philosophy or, you know, science or, you know, well-known, you know, periods of history, and he would weave them into stories such that I bet a lot of people went and looked up the real story just because he tickled your fancy. He was a very gentle teacher, I thought, and a very powerful one for that.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I did say I wanted to get into... there was one particular period in this March... for the podcast, when you kind of had an erudite rant, Steve.
Yep. When was that?
When was that? This was the... I'm just looking down the site here. This would be, is there grit in your school shoes? You weren't best pleased with the English education government's challenges to schools at the moment around character. You want to take us through that one a little bit?
Well, it's a double-edged thing, because on the one hand you think, we need to broaden out the kind of purposes and move schools beyond the kind of narrow exam drilling and testing, and this notion of, you know, character or virtue. They call it virtues at one point, so you're thinking in terms of like an ethical expansion, a kind of notion of citizenship or cosmopolitanism or whatever you like to call it. And you think, yeah, why not? You know, I'd like to warm to this. But then you put a rag of qualities why
Steve, you got a big bit of break up there. I wonder why now.
The sociological question is why the government... Yeah, so I was saying about, you know, that on the one hand, I wanted to warm to this because it does kind of suggest a broadening out of the narrow exam kind of attainment drilling that's going on in schools into something a bit more motivational and ethical. So, yeah, I wanted to warm to it. But I kind of, the sociological question is, you know, why now? You know, what's the kind of, why has it suddenly come in? When you would have thought that actually this was the bread and butter stuff of good schooling anyway. And you've got kind of such a kind of ragbag collection of qualities, you know. And my worry is with anything either party have done in government is that if you set up a program, they want to assess it and they want to get value for money. Therefore, you know, we're going to... your worry is that they then start to try and pin these things down, whereas actually they're very contextual sort of characteristics. You know, the notion of virtue is something that you doing the right thing at the right place in the right time, and certainly in the Aristotelian tradition is something that you don't have when you're young. You have to learn it from good models, good modeling, you know. And it's not good modeling to try and pin these things down and then assess them and tick box them, which is what a lot of good educational thinking tends to end up as, you know. Let's, can we tick it? Can we say we've done it? So I was a bit kind of a bit mixed about it. And also the other thing that you kind of worry about is that character has, there's a kind of a lot of ideological associations with character, you know, the kind of, when I went to school, it's a sort of, I went to a selective grammar school, you know, and we had to play sport on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, you're I was in really interested in that. You're of the privileged classes then in terms
I
of
am
the
of
selective
the,
grammar
yeah,
school.
No, yeah. Yeah, absolutely I'm of the privileged classes, which is kind of, you know, I kind of rebelled in my own teenage kind of adolescent way.
You went in that photographic meme that's doing the rounds on Facebook and stuff just now with David Cameron and some of the cabinet there, all with their private school uniforms on. You didn't go there?
Oh, no. For goodness sake, no. Oh, no, I'd have hated that. No, I don't do Facebook. I was absolutely, I mean, that's the thing about...
So privileged, but not actually posh.
No, yeah, absolutely. I was privileged because I passed the 11 plus at an early age and, you know, it was kind of got all the advantages of that. But what I was saying is the notion of character in that world, you know, the notion of the kind of the Bullington Club character is actually a kind of very bullying male version of, you know, let's send the troops over the trenches and get them, you know, we can send all these young men to war. And if they don't go over the trenches, they lack character, you know, they lack moral fiber. This is kind of very imperialist notion of what character is. So character does quite a lot of ideological work, you know, and that's the danger in it.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, my concern is that when a government says, oh yeah, we need more character, what it means is actually we need more people who can do what they're told and put up with the shitty life that we're going to prepare them for.
I suppose I should just place this in context. The story that prompted it was the government's set up a £3.5 million fund in England to place character education on a par with academic learning, and they're going to give it out to schools or authorities, if I understand it correctly, that can do something, you know, slightly innovative, but the government's already tailed it down. You know, it's around perseverance, resilience, grit, confidence, optimism, you know, these sort of positive things. There's a whole set of things, honesty, integrity, yeah, tolerance. And I think what came across in the piece, I'd really enjoyed reading it. It was very much about your tension that you've just described, that you kind of want to be supportive about this, but you just don't trust the language, you don't trust some of the connotations around this stuff, you know. And it struck me as I read it that our old friend John Lloyd, if I get the right name, John,
yes,
Lloyd,
yeah, yeah,
who
absolutely
does all the work around citizenship in England, mm-hmm, could have probably taken the same fund and the same ideas and presented it in a way that it was about, you know, resilience, you know, a la Guy Claxton, that kind of resilience about,
yeah,
you know, learners, you know, learning, you know, a different kind of grit, you know, something more about, you know, toughening up in terms of challenging themselves and having fun in their learning rather than giving up. But this just, you can't help thinking it's a wee bit like that movie, if you remember that one.
Yeah, yeah, that's
the
right.
Malcolm, you know, was it, who was it? Roddy McDowell,
yeah,
film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And did you pick up on that story at all anyway?
I read Steve's piece on it, but I haven't seen the film If, so I don't know what that's about.
It's very much about a privileged school like that, but what happens is they rebel in the end from the military, kind of, you know, a cadet sort of thing that goes hand in hand with it, and they start shooting teachers and whatnot. It's a bit of a dark, you know, film, but yeah, it's the same theme. It's about the school trying to instill these values of, you know, grit and obedience and moral fibre and stuff.
Sounds like one to watch over Easter holidays.
Yeah.
Not. I don't know. I suppose, like Steve, I'm a bit mixed. I mean, this stuff here, I would hope that it's part of a normal classroom. You learn this stuff just absolutely, as a matter of course, as you go about your daily business every day. This stuff should be happening. But then sometimes I think, well, it might be obvious for you, but it's maybe not obvious for other people. So it's nice to have it written down. But then as soon as they talk about trying to test it and assess it, I think, well, that makes me doubt the whole thing entirely. It's a bit strange. And it reminds me of what one of the speakers that I was listening to at the Reading Reform Foundation conference in London last Saturday. And Gordon Askew was there. He used to be the Department for Education phonics advisor. And he did a half-hour talk. It was great, but it was really timely. And he spoke about, you know, the things that you can test and things that you can't test. And he said, you know, don't try to test or assess the unmeasurable. Assess what you need to develop, but don't try to test it. So he was saying there's some things we can teach and test. There's some things that we can develop and test, and there are other things that we just have to encourage. You can't actually test them. Mm-hmm. So I feel that's in the same sort of vein.
No, I think it's a really good point, Anne. And can I just sort of, and while I think about it, just sort of, because I think it does tie into your point. We got this list here, long list, and then there's another kind of, there's other lists coming out from other people because it seems to be making a bit of an international wave, this character education, and they're different lists. And if we go back to The Treasure Within, we've got four very simple pillars. And you and I have said this so often, Matthew. What is wrong with just having those four simple pillars, which to me would encompass all that stuff? And like you said, Anne, you could then build a kind of what you could assess from those pillars and what you can't assess. You know, you could actually start to, rather than having a kind of somebody coming up with one sort of bag of qualities and somebody coming up with something that's almost the same, you know. And I reviewed this character education.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, it's a lovely link there, actually. Yep.
Yeah, but when you broke it down, I mean, that had thousands of words in it, you know, for each kind of the kind of, I don't know how many key headings, but underneath each key heading was another 1,000 words to describe it. So what's the point? Because it doesn't have any, it doesn't add any explanatory value. In fact, the simpler you make this thing, which is why we came back to the treasure within, you know, learning to do, learning to live with others, learning to be, it seems to sum it all up, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it would be good for us to get back in touch with those simpler curricular values. However, Anne, do you have anything else you want to take us to, or will we continue mining Steve's stuff here?
No, I'm happy to carry on mining Steve.
Okay, well, in that case, Steve, I have a bone to pick with you.
Oh, no. Shall I give you a treat for it?
Oh, dear. Yeah, obviously you were feeling very peppy and you've been munching your Bob Martins this month.
Tail's wagging, the eyes are glistening. Come on.
Absolutely, yeah. You gave me a bit of a ribbing. And you know that that's not fair because I've never ribbed you on any of our previous podcasts or even...
I know what's coming up.
let me read this bit to you, Anne, if you didn't pick this up this month. This is Steve's piece, incidentally, which I loved, which is reflecting on, you know, his almost your alter ego, you know, your gentle mindfulness side, you know, working your allotment and helping support the community there of, you know, the allotment people and what you're doing. You know, it's really brilliant. It's the kind of learning we wanted to get into in this, but let me get this. If I might just pull out a few weeds here before I get to the root of the story. Unlike Matthew... He spits. I am not a great fan of psychology as an enterprise. Some psychological research is obviously very scholarly and very empirical, and probably very worthwhile in some way. Perhaps it's the way I'm wired, but I prefer the sociological and philosophical aspects of inquiry. Bear with me. I find myself suspicious of the way psychology has become pop, seeming to worm its way into our contemporary life world by offering some how to do it 3 steps to heaven. It's all more David Brent than serious thinking. So Steve has homed in on the very thing that fascinates me in learning and given it a right good slap.
But if you'd read it closely, you'd have seen the word enterprise. So it's not kind of psychology per se necessarily. It's the way it's become an enterprise. And it's sold on.
Listeners should know that Steve and I have a deep and abiding love, and this kind of mutual ribbing on the cast is only on the magazine is only healthy. But I'll tell you, it did in no small way get me into the mindfulness piece because I was determined to, you know, to move from my attraction to behavioural economics and see what you would maybe think of it at its worst as pop psychology into something a bit more, you know, a bit more reflective.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the thing about the allotment piece was I mean, they obviously, there's some obvious metaphors, which I didn't want to work, you know, the motifs of growing stuff. That wasn't the one I was interested in. It was just the social conditions in the allotment. You know, there was a community there which has got its kind of characters and disagreements. And in fact, there was a rather kind of rather heated discussion I overheard the other day on the allotment. But actually, everyone comes together in the end because they're all there for a common purpose. And you can say good morning to everyone, and everyone says hello. And if you want help, if you want to know the best way of growing spuds and which kind of spuds grow best up there, you only just have to ask, you know. And it just seemed to me to say more about the social conditions of a learning practice that it just, you know, you've got a community of very different people from very different backgrounds. You know, I had a discussion with somebody up there about saying, oh, I'm going to vote Tory next time. And I said to him, oh, I've never voted Tory in my life and I don't intend to do so now. But it was a very kind of very agreeable discussion. You know, I mean, we just we got on with our weeding. Do you know what I mean? So the kind of point of it really was to look more at the allotment as a kind of the social conditions for good learning.
Yeah, I guess if I was trying to, you know, if I'm, you know, stepping away from the teasing, you know, what I took from it was that you're saying that much of the philosophical and sociological debate that we have, frankly, could be more effective if it was grounded. You know, your community, you have a common purpose, which is actually quite an emotional and quite a practical purpose, you know, which is, you know, about working the land, you know, for want of a, you know, of maybe a less grand phrase, and the common interest in that, you mm-hmm. know, so everything that you do and your wry observation that there are camps, you know, with people that want to hyper-organise everything and those that want to go with the flow a little bit more, maybe like yourself. But actually the reason it doesn't come to, you know, to blows metaphorically or otherwise is because you are all grounded in something practical and common.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think you put your finger on it. And it's the same with, you know, like if you've got a group of knitters or a book club or a cycling club, you know, you're going to get people who maybe hate each other, but actually at the end of the day, they go out on their bikes and they ride, you know. And it's something that we kind of can do if you've got the opportunity in adult life, but why aren't, you know, where is it encouraged, that kind of thing with young people? It seems to be more outside of school that it's encouraged than within school.
And there's an interesting parallel there in education, I think, isn't there? That, you know, we do have people that philosophically really detest each other in education. You know, people that just don't get each other's viewpoint. And in a sense, you know, the parallel here would be that, you know, the working of the land in your context there should be like the educating of children, you know, as a common, you know, shared purpose. But it, you know, for me, the parallel partially carries over, but not fully.
Well, what I liked about what Steve said was when he said, you know, I can ask someone, you know, what potato should I plant here or whatever. Mm. But we're not, you know, no one at the end is going to be judging your potatoes and
Absolutely.
Giving prizes out for the biggest potatoes. And then people might not be so willing to give up their time and their advice to you. Yeah. And I think bringing it back to education, you know, we're arguing over what we should be using in the allotment, what fertilisers and what this and what that. And we're all trying to you know, make our crops the biggest and the best, but not necessarily sharing in the way that we should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's...
Can I suggest as we get... sorry, Steve, any last observations on
no,
that?
No, no, I think, and put it absolutely right, you know, that was exactly, that was one of the intentions behind the article, yeah.
Okay, but just because of the quantity, I think, of things that we've written, and particularly because of the whole set of interlinks there in those articles of yours, because, you know, we could go on to link it to your piece about the guy who wrote about stepping back from academia and, you know, working the land, and the piece about the sheep farming.
Oh, yeah.
Which is lovely. I can't remember the title of that. I don't have it in front of me. What was
it? Shepherding Learning.
Shepherding Learning, yeah. You've got a real theme. You know, there's something really... In fact, in some ways, I would suggest that, you know, as April goes on, maybe what one of your posts should be is a tying together of that theme and just trying to have a summary piece that's around whatever draws out of them, because there is something there, isn't there, about grounded learning and, you know, about us, you know, losing foundations for what we do and how that then causes a discord in our learning together. But anyway... Let's talk about the piece that Jay wrote.
Mm.
And maybe briefly before we finish, we can go on to the piece that I think we're more than one from
Gillian.
Forgiveness for Gillian Campbell-Thow, you know, who wrote a couple of pieces for us this month, didn't she?
Yeah.
Jay's piece was interesting. Jay and I have agreed that we're going to try and write a serious, you know, kind of responding to each other, you know, about school leadership, just simply because we both have a role in developing that now with our respective jobs. So we thought it'd be nice if we could have a bit of a win-win and you'll be able to pull some of this narrative out to use in our learning and our training. And my previous piece, I think, had been around, you know, your personality and your style as a leader and what you would try and change. Because leaders, you know, I think I would argue one of the definitions of a leader is that you try and make change happen. And your style will dictate whether that's just evolutionary gentle, you know, trying to be a wee bit better at what your previous leaders did, or whether you're, you know, trying to rethink the system and, you know, be a bit more Delors about it, you know, a bit more, building the four pillars. But what was then needed was a piece really thinking about, what's the rationale for that? Why has change now, you know, at a premium? And he wrote a lovely piece for us called The Times They Are A-Changing. I think Steve gave him the title, actually, in his editing role, is School Leadership. And he's done a really nice job, starting from Ken Robertson about, you know, the Ken Robinson, sorry, about the, you know, the kind of background and history to how education itself has developed, but actually taking us through the, basically through to the computer era, you know, when suddenly, you know, change that you could track in terms of big epochs almost, you know, the industrial age, the agricultural age, really, you know, and I suppose when you think about that, the agricultural age was, what, 2,000-3,000 years, I suppose, you know, however you want to look at it, maybe in the UK terms, was probably more like 1,000 years, you know, forgive me, you know, playing fast and loose with the numbers here, but then the factory age was, what, 150 years, 200 years, you know, and now suddenly we're in this incredible time when we've got the computer chip, Moore's Law. You know, when you cast your mind back, the first Apple computers were, what, in the 80s or something, Steve, you know?
Mm.
And now look at the world we're in, you know, we're carrying phones that get more computing power than spaceships had, you know, in the moonshots of the 70s, you know, the 60s and 70s. To say that is silly because it's, you know, by such a large margin that, you know, it's hardly worth saying it, but thousands of times more computing power in your phone. And we're outsourcing our own memories and things. You know, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I'll give you an example of it, as some of you will know from one or two of my articles or quotes, at least. I'm reading or listening to the audiobook of The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence. Which is beautifully written, wonderful. Getting a bit dull, I have to say. I'm 15 hours or 16 hours into listening to it, and it's a bit dull, but... But actually, I'm sitting on a train listening to that and suddenly thinking, I'm struggling to get a picture here of this because he's talking about the names for the Middle East from the 1920s. I Googled it on my phone and I'm sitting watching maps that were offered to me of different periods of how the different names and places, and then I've got maps of, you know, Lawrence's actual, you know, journeys and the, you know, his stomping grounds as he carries out the campaign against Turkey at that point in the Arab Revolt. I think how amazing this is. I almost don't have to remember or know this stuff. I'm almost able to just look it up anywhere. And we should be careful here because you're talking to us tonight from, you know, from from Isle of Lewis. So I suppose you don't just casually use your mobile phone for that level of access everywhere. But,
no.
But you wouldn't take long before you got to a proper network point and you could look up anything.
I don't know. That's got all my alarm bells ringing.
So I suppose all I was getting to was just saying, I think Jay did a lovely piece that takes us through a nice piece of gentle, you know, history of the backgrounds to education, and basically saying,
yeah,
you know, we got to move fast now because the world's moving fast.
Well, I think also the key point was that trying to be in control of this change, because it's going to happen anyway. That's one of the things, you know. So how much are we in charge of it? We're just letting it happen around us, and I mean, it's a kind of powerful argument. Although on the one hand, you do have to question whether all progress is good. You perhaps ought to read John Gray, who was professor of, I think, European thought in one of the London universities. written quite a book, a number of. Essays about the kind of the notion of progress we had and how mistaken it is, but that's another story for another time.
I just love that this is the podcast you come to as an antidote to 50 Shades of Grey. You know, all over the country, people are reading this other book, and Steve's here telling you the right grey to read. Thank you for this, Steve. You keep this right.
Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I think one of the things that we have to be careful of is that, that leadership is about anticipating and being with change and kind of try to look forward, but also to recognise, I think, that we don't have the calculus. You know, that's one of the contemporary myths, you know, particularly of Western modernity, that actually... a manager can pin this stuff down and we can't, you know, it's just too complex. So I'm really kind of struck by the point Anne made earlier that actually we have to look at what we can be in charge of, so to speak. You know, what is it that we can pin down and what is it that we can't pin down? And I think there's a further trick underneath this article, I think, to look at.
Anne, you were going to say something there. There was a bit of a...
No, just what you were...
I sensed.
Yeah, just what you said and also what's in Jay's article there. It just gets my spidey senses going when we...
You just... Come on, Anne. Own up. You just want some kind of a cape. Whatever you're doing in this this podcast, you know, as writer, girl, right. You know...
Yeah. I want a cape, yes.
Actually, I should just... Sorry, I don't think spider... All of the pedants are all writing at this very moment. Dear Matthew, Spider-Man doesn't have a cape. For goodness sake, you know you're Marvel or DC or whatever. Sorry, Anne.
This bit about the, is there still a need to rote retain so many facts that are available in your phone? I'm aware that the answer to this is a qualified well, yes and no. You know, yes, we've got Google at our fingertips, and yes, you were able to look up all that stuff that you were reading. But unless you had, you know, a real decent level of general knowledge in the first place, you would have nothing to fit that into. Do you see what I mean? What you found out.
Yeah,
you need to already have knowledge there. And what really frightens me is, you know, when you're talking about, for example, leaders that need to sort of think about this and forward think, it just reminded me of, I can't even remember where I saw it or where I heard it, but a head teacher in a school who was showing somebody around and said, look, we don't, our library, it's all digital now. They'd no books, and they were really, really proud of this. But that frightens me, because sometimes this is the road that people are going down thinking that's progress, yeah. You know, that they're future-proofing things and actually they're just mucking things up. So it's wee things like that, and I think, oh, ding-a-ling-a-ling, just watch, you know, what you're saying there. Yes, we have Google, but we still need to ensure that children have really good levels of general knowledge, because anything you read, your comprehension will depend on that level of general knowledge that you have. You can't rely on Google to do it all for you. Google will certainly enhance and let you go deeper and discover things and add to that knowledge, but you've got to have a baseline to begin with.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, typically you do like to survey our stories like a bloodhound, you know, and like a greyhound in your pursuit of the sort of speed of coming in to keep us writing these things. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, and I think Jay would probably, you know, be happy and acknowledge that as well. I suppose he was just trying to say that, you know, there is something going on there that's moving fast, but yeah, yeah, I guess he's not. Well, I hope he's not. You know, saying we'll chuck out all of the old values, because. Perkins, of course, David Perkins has been very, I think, very powerful in reminding us that, you know, to learn things, you still have to have a framework of understanding, don't you? You've got to have scaffolding in your head that, yeah, you look up something in Google, but you've got to know something already to hang it on. It's like you've got to have a loose framework to at least put those hooks on.
Yeah.
I experienced that recently. I read Millennium, the history by Tom Holland of, you know, the period of, you know, 900 onwards, when the whole world went a bit crazy with people thinking the world would end at the year 1000. But it romps all around from, you know, Vikings invading the east coast of Great Britain, or whatever it was called then, to, you know, to the sort of papal machinations that were happening and the empire of the Franks, you know. And honestly, I can remember virtually nothing of it. You know, so the facts were there. I could have looked it up in Google or read the book as it happens. Mm-hmm. Made no difference. I didn't have enough of a framework of understanding of Dark Age history to hang any bit of it on. So, Anne, I think your point is extremely well made.
Actually, and it does link. I know we're coming close to the end of this time, so I just want to bring in this because it does link to, because Gillian Campbell Thau has written a couple of nice articles for us, but the Bring Your Own Dug one, because it which was I didn't get the kind of, it must be some subtitle required for that for me, South of Hadrian's Wall, but
she's written just saying articles this month.
Yeah,
but she's just pretty prolific. Thank you, Gillian.
Yeah, she just saying about, she watched a student teacher do a lesson, and it was iPad-tastic. You know, he had all the stuff, all the technology, and it was going beautifully. But then she asked him to do a lesson without the technology, and he said, oh, he had to work harder, and he felt really naked about it, you know. And, you know, so I thought that was quite an important lesson there, and I think it relates to what Anne was saying, that actually there's... we can get lost in the processes and forget the kind of content.
Absolutely, yeah. Anne, did you happen to catch that one?
I didn't know. I've not read that one yet, but I love the bring your own dog, bring your own device. That was genius.
What I noticed as well is that she brought out a bit of the Just a Minute in me for Radio 4 fans, because she's used Computer Says No in that one. Has she not used that in her most recent article as well? She's obviously a big Little Britain fan. But yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? You know, because we've had this... Actually, I think we're having a growing up just now. You know, nationally, we're realising that technology is... You know, do you remember a time, Anne, maybe about 10 years ago, maybe even more, 10 to 15 years ago, when teachers who were going for jobs believed that they always had to say, oh, and I make full use of technology in the classroom. And now, I think if we're really honest, there's now a much more shared tacit acceptance that, yeah, none of us really know what that means anymore. You know, that actually, we know that you'll get the odd lesson when you nail it, or you've used a great game online or something like that with youngsters, or you've used your interactive whiteboard really well because you found an activity that lends itself to it. But the idea that somehow that dominates, you know, more than 5% of your lessons is I think, kind of receding a little bit now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't think anybody could make the claim I'm making full use of technology. There's too much now to make that claim.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we just go to Anne's most recent one? Not Anne's. Gosh, Anne, I've had a real problem tonight. I'm almost half the way
I'll
into this bottle. It must be that, Anne, sorry. let's look at Gillian's latest one, which was... There is a new one, isn't there? Where is it?
It's probably because it's in April, so we need to talk about it in April.
Oh, sorry, right, we'll come back to that then. So I was actually going to link to a new April one, right? I'm going to have to get the discipline of the website.
Yep.
But let's just briefly mention her Lingolove one.
Yeah.
I thought that was really nice as well. She did a lovely piece around, you know, not making a big wide point, you know, just reflecting on something that she's learning. And it's something I think that the website needs much more of. You know, I love the idea that people would just say a little bit about how it feels to learn something. And I believe Gillian's got a new job, Anne, hasn't she? She's leaving the classroom, and I know that she's angst-ridden about it. She's doing some work for Glasgow Council now, half of her time, as she always has, but it's become more formalised now, promoting languages and, you know, being being an officer for that. But she's also half her time now as a teacher trainer in languages, so she's really got an interest, you know, for Strathclyde University. Or University of Strathclyde, I should say. But she's, as part of this, been given the remit, Steve, you know, as someone's retired, to take over Gaelic, the coordination of Gaelic learning in Glasgow. And I believe she doesn't speak Gaelic, you know, so although she seems to speak about 15 languages, so, you know, I guess we've got some sympathy for that. But she's just done a lovely practical piece, and I love this on her website, that, you know, I might want to go and learn a language, or I might want to go and learn... I'd like to learn, for example, to dance. I'm a terrible dancer. I've been phobic all my life of it, you know, and I've had a few experiences recently that have made me think that I'm now mature enough at, you know, the age of 48 that maybe I could start to enjoy it and learn something. I don't know whether it would ever be worth it for me. But it's lovely to think, how would I do that? You know, what would I need to do first? And her piece is great. She breaks down how she learned the pipe organ as a little, you know, lead-in, and then talks about how she learns languages. And for me, it's actually beautifully, you know, tied in with that David Perkins idea about having a scaffold in your mind. You already know the big frameworks of how a language works. So she listens and talks and reads and starts to look for the pattern. She pulls out the, you know, it's almost like a child would learn language, isn't it? You know, that she starts to look for, what are the verbs? And then, oh my goodness, no, the verbs don't have the same form as such, you know. So she's actually learning a language in a very generic way. You know, she's looking for the big generic patterns. And then, you know, the specific examples come out. And how she does that doesn't really matter, but she writes it with her, you know, with her usual humour, you know, talking about, you know, speaking Italian like a demented Spaniard. I just love that, you know. But a great piece, you know. If I was learning languages, you know, I would read that and think, I can't do it like that, Gillian, because I don't have the framework in my head, but I would understand that at least. And I just find it inspiring. Maybe if I was going to go and learn, I mean, my parallel would be, if I was going to learn how to play a stringed instrument, you know, maybe if I was going to learn to play something like the cittern, which I did try once, but I didn't actually persist with it more than days, you know. If I was going to go and learn how to play the, you know, the English cittern, I already play a bit of mandolin, and I play a little bit of, well, I play a lot of guitar, you know. I've got a framework in my head. I would start to look for the patterns and figure out what the intervals were, what the scale points were, you know, what were the chordal structures, you know. And it's just like she learns a language, so I just loved that. It was great. So I suppose that's a good piece for us to, you know, to end the review of the month on. One of two things to do. It's also worth saying that, that two out of Gillian's three pieces, what she's done is she's blogged them on her own site, and simultaneously been kind enough to post them for us, you know, on eachandeverydog.net. Steve, is it okay for me to say that, you know, that that's a great way to go? If anyone's writing a blog piece and they're promoting their own site, you know, this isn't an either or. Each and Every Dog is about pulling the ideas together that, that make some kind of sense in terms of bringing an eclectic magazine together. So if anyone out there is listening and thinks, well, I don't have time to write for Each and Every Dog, but I'm doing something myself, you know, we're not, you know, we're not looking for exclusives. You know, just help us to pull together a story of learning. So anything you want to share with us, we, you know, we would love to have. That would be great. And the other thing is, we thought we would try, Steve and I discussed a wee bit through the month, that it might be fun to kind of invite some pieces this month. So what we thought we would do is put out an invitation, and maybe on Twitter we'll follow this up, Steve. If anyone out there is listening and thinks, do you know what, I wouldn't mind writing for Each and Every Dog, you know, just to throw my tuppence worth into the debate, but I'm not really sure, I've got nothing to write, I think it'd be lovely this month to hear about things that people have found hard to learn. You know, what have you tried to learn that you found tough? And why? What were the obstacles? What did it feel like? You know, what angle on it, you know, would have made it different, you know, and why did you ultimately not, you know, reach success with that? Or even a different angle might be, what success did you find with it, even though you didn't really get where you wanted to? So, you know, the theme of stuff that you found tough to learn, if anyone out there wants to contribute, we'd love to hear about that. So one last thing to do, and that's to do the conversation we didn't manage on the way in. Steve, when I was asking you earlier on before we started, how have you been? You were quite motivated about last night's big political debate.
Yeah, I thought it was a good format, actually. I thought it was going to be a mess, but it wasn't.
This is the
leaders debate, yeah. It was really well chaired. I thought all the women leaders came across a lot better than the men. So we obviously need more women politicians.
Sorry, I have to intercede here. Listeners don't have the benefit of seeing your two beautiful faces on Skype, but I'm seeing them. And Anne, the word smug is dancing around my consciousness here. Sorry, Steve, carry on.
I thought Natalie Bennett made some really good points, particularly about education, which was avoided.
She was the Green Party rep, yeah?
Yeah. But actually, I thought the best performance and kind of, because she was kind of showed compassion and had a lot of passion and was actually had some radical ideas, which the Labour Party seemed to have lost sight of, was Nicola Sturgeon. So I was wondering whether she might come and emigrate to Scotland. I mean, the only thing that worries me about that is if you kind of, with nationalism, I think we ought to be looking at a more cosmopolitan politics generally. The only concern is because nationalism, I mean, it was dressed up in really kind of passionate socialism, which is kind of fine, but it could also be dressed up in passionate conservatism or fascism.
Yeah, that's an interesting tension, isn't it, with the SNP position? You know, they have stolen the clothes of the left because they are naturally a left-leaning party. But you're right, it could have been, you know, it could have been the other way around.
But no, I was really impressed with Nicola Sturgeon's performance. I thought she and Leanne Wood, the Plaid Cymru leader, really put Nigel Farage in his place at one point. It was brilliant.
I missed that bit, but I read about it. Yeah, I saw the second half of the debate. I thought that what was interesting about that was that Leanne Wood missed a trick. You know, Nicola Sturgeon's obviously become a bit of a bogeyman. Sorry, she's representing a bogeyman party in England at the moment. You know, that people are a bit cheesed off with the nationalism. Although, to be fair to Nicola, she's playing the ball as she finds it at the moment, you know. But but she was very good at reaching out and saying, don't be scared of our politics. We're going to support the left in the UK more widely anyway, you know. And as long as you're not hung up on our, you know, our self-determination agenda, you know, we'll work with you on this, you know. But absolutely. I thought Leanne would miss that trick. She talked more about Wales than philosophy.
I think the politics of the process are quite interesting because Leanne Wood was obviously targeting Labour in Wales because she's obviously fighting Labour in Wales.
Yeah.
And Nicola Sturgeon was obviously kind of trying to ward off the people who might be worried, as you said, you know, about the SNP influence. And Cameron and Miliband were only interested in each other.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of fighting out. And I thought kind of Natalie Bennett, kind of everyone in a sense afterwards ignored her, even though she made some really good points, because actually they're thinking, well, the Greens aren't going to matter, you know. And it was quite interesting to see who was targeting who in terms of, because, and also Nicola Sturgeon was obviously targeting Labour. You know, a lot of points she made were directly to Miliband about Labour policies in Scotland, because, you know, that's where her votes are going to come from. Obviously the Tories don't matter in Scotland either, you know.
And now that we've heard from the two blowhard windbag men on tonight's podcast, could we have the girly view on this one? I do love to put my head in the lion's mouth once in a while. Sorry,
I'm letting you off tonight. You're all right.
Thank you.
No, girl power than you are. It was fabulous. I think Nicola Sturgeon, what a role model. All the women did so well. And really, how refreshing, you know, to see the women with, you know, out there up against the men. The men paled in comparison. And I think they learned a big lesson. You know, they obviously weren't worried going into it about the women, but certainly after it, you know, they'd been told or they'd been told.
Oh, the polls have been clear, haven't they? They've pretty much, you know, given that message.
And I can't, I know I'm doing her a disservice. I can't remember the chairman's
Julie Etchingham.
Yeah, I thought she was brilliant.
She was,
you know,
great.
Because there was none of this confrontational antagonistic. It was very gutted, to the point, well directed. I thought the whole thing quite worked well, actually.
It was interesting, wasn't she? But as you say, not antagonistic, not aggressive, just firm. I loved her use of that simple device when she was trying to shut people up when their time was up. Instead of saying your time is up, just thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. It was like a positive psychology thing, wasn't it? You know, I need you to stop. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
She was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Well.
So I'm going to just. Sorry, Steve.
I think we've done a full podcast here.
We certainly have, and we've now got this new world, haven't we? With this luxury of a monthly podcast. You know, I was looking forward to this podcast from, you know, 3 days into the month. It's genuinely true. Whereas in the old days, when we used to run Inside Learning, we all got in the end the tyranny of the weekly podcast. Oh, I haven't read the news. It's only one day to the podcast. You know, this is great. You know, being able to just take our time. So anyway. Anne, closing thoughts from all of us. What would you like to point us all to? Any listeners that have enjoyed hearing you tonight? Obviously, your new website.
Yes, just www.thelearningzoo.co.uk.
And on Twitter,
just at Anne Glennie. But really, just want to wish everybody a happy Easter and enjoy all the Easter eggs and all the Easter egg hunts. That's it. Make the most of the holidays for the teachers.
Thank you very much, Anne. Steve, parting thoughts?
No, just to wish everyone a good break. Recharge the batteries. Because I know it's getting tough, particularly for teachers out there, really tough at the moment. So I hope everyone's been able to hold on to their values.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. We know we're getting downloads. We know we get a lot of readers now on the Each and Every Dog. I'll try that again. Eachandeverydog.net magazine. Go and look at it, contribute. We really are looking to grow a broad debate here. Thank you for listening. It's been just a pleasure talking to you guys tonight. So from Anne, from Steve and I, and from eachandeverydog.net, it's good night.
Good night.
Good night.